Creamery.com. I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Two recent fatal shootings by law enforcement officers in New Hampshire have raised questions about police training and tactics. And today in The Exchange, we're tackling this topic. But first, we take some time to remember Ray Burton, who died early this morning. The longtime North Country executive counselor announced a few weeks ago that his kidney cancer had returned, and so he'd not run for re-election. And in his last few weeks of life, his service was honored in ceremonies and dedications and was praised not just in the North Country, but across the state. Joining us now on the phone is someone who had a longtime friendship with Burton, John Harrigan, North Country writer and farmer. John, thanks a lot for being here. Really appreciate it.
Well, good morning, Laura. I'm honored to be part of the remembrances of Ray Burton. He was a lifelong friend. We appreciate what he's done over the years. I was thinking as I was waiting to go on this morning. The minute I picked the phone up to call Ray, the problem was in the process of being solved. Guy was just a phenomenal public service.
Well, John, big loss for you, big loss for the North Country and for New Hampshire, I would say. How are people there reacting to the news this morning?
Well, you know, we knew it was coming. Everybody did who had anything to do with Ray. And he went out with grace, just as he would grace any ceremony or gathering with his presence. One of my enduring remembrances of Ray is of him playing the piano, which he did with great flourish. Happy as a clam in the middle of a crowd, most of whom he had known for many years. And I don't know what everybody's planning for Ray, but if he was standing here, I think he would say, just invite everybody and find somebody to play the piano.
Wow, I didn't know that. You know, you said, John, when you had a problem and you started to call Ray about it, he was already working on it. The Executive Council has really limited powers, as you know. It approves government contracts, gubernatorial nominees. That's kind of it. So how did Ray Burton use that very limited position, John, to help people, including yourself?
Well, he networked with such a consummate ease. I remember when there was a chance for him to run for Congress, and he probably could have been elected. But a lot of people, including me, said, Ray, stay where you are. We can't replace you. Nobody can do this job as well as you can. There are plenty of people who can go to Congress and run around with a congressional plate. But I like that New Hampshire license plate number one.
Wow.
So he took that encouragement with a lot of pledges to do even better. And that's what the way Ray was. He was always looking for some kind of improvement. But I would say, well, Ray, you're doing exactly what you need to do. You cannot improve. So he was that kind of guy. You know, I could always kid around with Ray. The other neat thing about Ray, if three people stood in one place, the joke was that Ray Burton would pop out of the ground and hand you a comb. he was famous for handing out combs.
Hand you a comb? How come?
Well, he just said that was his thing. He had these black combs, and they were embossed with, you know, Ray Burton, the governor's counselor. So he was always giving them out. In fact, I was just talking to my wife about this. She and her father, Clarence from Michigan, were running around. I think it was Lancaster Fair. And I spotted Ray, and he spotted me. And we always would make a beeline for each other. And he wound up, you know, fishing a comb out of his pocket and handing it to this guy from Michigan. And right afterwards, Clarence said, what was that all about? And my wife said, well, that's what he does. That's his thing. He'll talk about problems in politics, but you always get a comb out of it.
So you may still have your problem, but at least your hair looks good.
Yeah, but boy, I'll tell you, there's never a question or a problem that I threw at Ray that he didn't get on right away quick. I never, ever failed to get an answer from him.
You know, John, you covered Ray Burton as a journalist, given your longtime involvement in North Country newspapers. How do you cover somebody like that who almost seems sort of beyond reproach?
Well, first of all, you have to have your bag ready and be ready to go from place to place over this huge district.
Sure.
I mean, Ray would drive, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles a week. He tried to get to every event that he was ever invited to. So if I was going to cover him, truly cover him, I'd have to have a tent or a sleeping bag or something. There was no way to cover Ray except to cover him as a person because there were so many things that he did and issues he got involved in that it would fill a book.
You know, people often use the word public servant to describe Ray Burton, John. Not the less flattering term, politician. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. Ray was the epitome of the term apolitical. He did not care about what party you were from, what your political bent might be. He just took you at face value as a person. That's the way I think most people regarded Ray. He wasn't a Republican necessarily. He could have been a Democrat just as well. I think he would have approached his job in the very same manner, no matter what party he was from. But, Ray, the last thing he would ask you was who you were affiliated with, what political agenda you had. That wasn't Ray at all. He really didn't care. I called him a libertarian in Republican clothing. So I think that's the way he was. The other endearing and enduring vision I have of Ray is at the Lilac Festival in Lisbon. Ray loved that parade. He was on his home turf. Lisbon and Woodsville and Bath all sort of hang together. And that Lilac Festival parade, I always thought, was Ray's sublime moment. And he always appeared in one huge convertible or another, waving to everybody, people from the crowd along the street yelling, "Hey, Ray." And he almost came up with a name. Almost always he would say, "Hey, Bill," or "Hey, Joan."
Wow.
Unbelievable guy. Just a real people person and the epitome of a public servant.
Well, John, it's great to talk to you, and I'm really sorry for your loss.
Well, thank you, Lorna. It's the state's loss.
Okay. Take care.
Yeah, bye-bye now.
That's John Harrigan, North Country writer and farmer, again, remembering Ray Burton, who passed early this morning. In late September, a high-speed highway chase that began on Interstate 89 ended with a shootout in a residential Manchester neighborhood and a state trooper killing the runaway driver, Wendy Lawrence. The Attorney General's office investigated the incident, as it does with all so-called officer-involved shootings. 2 weeks later, the AG released its report. It finds the trooper's actions were justified, that he believed Lawrence was about to run him down with her car. But Lawrence's loved ones disagree. They feel the officer's use of deadly force was excessive, and the conflict could have been de-escalated before it ended in her death. What struck many about this case is that it happened just 6 weeks after another fatal officer-involved shooting, this one about a fleeing suspect in a drug sting operation in the town of Ware. Today in The Exchange, we're going to look at some of the questions that have come up, given these two events close together. Let's hear from you on this issue and on these questions. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Our Facebook page is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guest is Jeff Strutson. He's Senior Assistant Attorney General and Chief of the Homicide Unit at the AG's office. We'll be joined in a couple minutes by Buzz Scher, Professor at UNH Law. And Jeff, it's nice to meet you. Thank you very much for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, how often do we see these cases, Jeff, of officer-involved shootings? Because there was a lot of commentary about these cases happening so closely together.
Fortunately, they're not that common. We average usually about one or two a year, and they're a combination of fatal and non-fatal events. So it's usually about one or two a year.
So kind of unusual that we had these two almost back-to-back in sort of late August, early September.
Yeah, actually there were two in one night, the same night that the Manchester incident occurred. There was actually one in Dover within just a few hours as well.
So, wow.
So that is unusual.
So actually there were three within a short span of time.
That's correct.
The one in Dover was a little bit different, though, wasn't it?
It was an officer-involved incident where officers responded to a situation where a man had attacked a neighbor with a hammer. When the officers arrived, the man opened fire on the officers, and the officers returned fire. They ended up wounding him, but later on he actually took his own life. But because the officers used deadly force, meaning they fired their weapons and injured him, we did investigate that case.
So how do you think, Jeff, the public perceives this? You know, wow, three of these cases all within, relatively short time period.
Over the last few years, we've had more of these than we usually have, a combination of fatal and non-fatal. And so that question has come up. You know, we've been asked, is there a common theme with these? And probably the most common theme is that the people involved, the attackers involved, had substance abuse issues or mental health issues or a combination. So that seems to be one of the more common factors. These aren't just cases where you have a criminal who's trying to escape. They often involve people who have significant mental health or substance abuse issues. When we talk to their family members, we find out they either weren't taking their medication or they weren't able to get their medication. In some cases, family members try to get help for them and the system weren't able to, and they simply watch their loved one slide down. And unfortunately, by the time the police get there, it's too late. They've gone too far.
Wow. And there's a term that's going around that I might ask you about in a minute, Jeff, called, I think it's officer something suicide, where a person is having a mental health crisis and actually says to the police, come on.
Right. It's basically the term that's used is suicide by cop.
That's it.
Yep, suicide by cop. And we do see a fair number of that with these types of individuals where they're definitely trying to prompt the police to kill them.
Yikes. All right. Buzz Scher is with us on the phone, professor at UNH Law and president of the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union. Buzz, just real broadly, please, your thoughts on the fact that, you know, we've seen a couple of these cases in a relatively short time period. What are we to pull from this, Buzz?
I think it's a cyclical, in terms of the a lot of cases in a relatively short time period, it tends to be a cyclical thing. I've been in New Hampshire for, you know, over 30 years now, and you have collections of these events that seem to come one right after another, and then you don't have them for a period of time. So in terms of a lot right now, in the first instance, I think it's a matter of cyclical issues. Second, in terms of some of the cases involving mental health issues, both the federal and the state government have not been headed in a direction of providing more mental health services to needy populations. They've been heading in the other direction as a general proposition. That's the trend. And there are unfortunately, there are potential consequences to that.
All right. We'll be talking about that actually tomorrow on The Exchange. And we'll talk more about that coming up as well. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can post a comment on our Facebook page if you like. It's one word, NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And support for NHPR, as you've no doubt heard, comes from UR members. This week, we would like to especially thank all of our sustaining members for your pledge of ongoing support. Your monthly contribution provides NHPR a regular, reliable source of income and keeps this 24-hour news service on sound financial footing. Thank you. New Hampshire weather, mostly cloudy, chance of snow showers this morning, then turning partly sunny this afternoon. North Country could see some afternoon snow showers with total accumulations there around an inch. Windy highs today, mid-20s, northern Coos County ranging to 30s across the rest of the state. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and St. Mary's Bank, the nation's first credit union, helping New Hampshire families and businesses grow and prosper for over 100 years, online at stmarysbank.com. From The Telegraph, providing local news coverage and advertising opportunities for today's complexities, online at nashuatelegraph.com. And Dartmouth-Hitchcock Orthopedics, performing more than 1,000 hip and knee replacements annually. Information at lebanon.dhortho.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, officer-involved shootings in the Granite State. Give us your thoughts. We invite you to join us with your questions or comments. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. It's one word, NHPR Exchange. With me in studio, Jeff Strelzin, a Senior Assistant Attorney General, Chief of the Homicide Unit. On the phone, Buzz Scher, Professor at UNH Law, President of the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union. And joining us now for a few moments is Nick Willard. He's Manchester Assistant Police Chief. And Nick, thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, as I understand, 4 times a year, Manchester police have to complete training surrounding the use of force. What's involved in this training? What sorts of issues are you looking at?
Well, we look at scenario-based training. But at minimum, we do our use of force training required by the state, and that's once a year. And then 3 additional times throughout the year, we do survival-type training, tactics, techniques, and we reinforce the deadly force statute.
What does that deadly force statute say, Officer Willard, about when police can use deadly force or not? How does that sort of guide you?
Well, it guides us in that we reinforce when it's appropriate for an officer to discharge his firearm in a confrontation. If it's in defense of himself or a third person, what he reasonably believes is the imminent use of deadly force.
Yeah, reasonably believes, that's probably where some of the trouble comes in, right?
Well, trouble for I guess, those who are unfamiliar with the law.
Yeah.
What's reasonable for a trained police officer and the layperson who judges without having all the facts, I think that's where the quandary is.
Do you think that lay people misjudge these situations, sort of armchair quarterback it? You know, police went too far, pulled too quickly, should have held back a little bit more. What do you think, Officer Willard?
Well, I think it's disheartening when there are some in the public who make judgments before the facts are known or before the facts are in. You have to understand that these are human beings that we're talking about, that the police officer who's involved in these shootings, you know, they're subjected to that scrutiny as it's happening, as they're going through the process. And I think it's somewhat unfair to the officer, it's unfair to the profession, you know, allow the Attorney General's office to do their investigation, come up with their findings, and then if the layperson wishes to be critical, you know, I'm all for that. But during the process, I just find it at times to be disheartening.
Getting back to the training, Officer Willard, the state requires one unit per year, but you in Manchester do three additional trainings. How come?
We had a philosophical shift when Chief Maurer became the chief of police. We saw an increase in violent crimes where weapons were being used, and the murder of Officer Michael Briggs really reinforced that we want to be prepared for a confrontation. So, in light of that, the chief has kind of had a paradigm shift into more training so we're better prepared to deal with violent confrontations. And I think the fact that Officer Dan Daugherty survived his confrontation after he'd been shot five times reinforced that the chief made the right call in increasing our training.
What sorts of issues or factors come up in that training, Officer Willard? I mean, what sort of factors are officers taught to weigh, to assess? Clearly, you know, on the spot in a very stressful situation, but what sorts of things are you supposed to be assessing in these types of confrontations that could turn deadly?
When it's appropriate to even draw your weapon, when it's appropriate to use less lethal weapons other than your firearm, and that's something that we do a lot of training on. Pepper spray, tasers. So we actually reinforce the use of force continuum, where we start low, and then we get into the deadly force type scenario. And then once we're there, we reinforce when it's appropriate, when it's not appropriate. And then during the physical act of shooting, we are very pointed in our recognition of our target and ensuring that we hit what we're shooting at. So we do a lot of drills so, you know, there are no bystanders who may be hit and that type of thing.
So you're looking at a level of increasing force. When can I possibly use pepper spray, a taser, maybe shoot but not to kill? You're sort of looking at that escalation.
Well, no, we would never shoot for not to kill. I guess we don't shoot to injure a person. What we shoot is to eliminate the threat. So when you say we don't shoot to injure, so I'll hear somebody say, you know, why didn't they just shoot that person in the leg?
Right. That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah. And it's virtually impossible to have a violent confrontation with somebody that is probably bent on killing you or somebody else and having that wherewithal and the ability to just shoot somebody in the leg. It's not even something that we train for. You train to eliminate the threat, which typically means shooting somebody what we would call center mass.
Center mass means right in the middle of the body, basically.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
And again, it's to eliminate the threat. If it's gotten to the point where the officer believes his life or someone else's life is in danger, they have to take lethal action. That's what they're going to do. It's not where they're going to, you know, try to like Officer Dan Daugherty wasn't going to try to shoot this man in the leg after he shot him five times, if that makes any sense.
You know, when we talk about the opposite party, the suspect using deadly force, we often think a gun, maybe a knife, maybe a hammer, as Jeff Strelzin said earlier in the show. What about a car, Officer Willard? Is that considered a possible deadly weapon?
Well, I mean, of course it is. I've been in many fatal accidents in my career, and I've seen the damage of what a vehicle can do. And then if you put a highly charged, emotional individual behind that wheel, who is bent on getting either away from a policeman or running the policeman over. It really isn't to what's in the mind of the police officer at the time it's happening. And if he feels his life is in danger, then he's going to use deadly force.
Officer Will, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, ma'am.
That's Manchester Assistant Police Chief Nick Willard. Again, the number for you to join our conversation is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Buzz Schur, to you first. I'd love your thoughts on what Officer Willard told us about the extra training that they do in Manchester and that sort of escalation that they have to assess when they're facing a very dangerous situation, Buzz.
I think it's great that Manchester is doing that extra training. I mean, these circumstances are really difficult circumstances for police officers who've got to make some profound judgments in terms of the use of deadly force when they don't have perfect information in front of them. And that's the real challenge of these moments. That said, you know, we struggle with the other end of that is I think there is a real concern about the perception of what's going on. To pick up on something Officer Willard spoke of, you know, I think the general public perceives a difference between somebody in a car who's trying to run somebody down, be it an officer or somebody else, and who's trying to escape. And fairly or not, it sometimes appears on the information that's provided that that the person who was shot and sometimes killed, that occurred because they were trying to escape. And I think the public views the justification for shooting someone who's trying to escape differently than the justification for shooting somebody who's trying to run somebody down. So my concern really is reflects, I think, the public's concern that officers are getting treated specially in evaluating these cases. And that can create a public perception that doesn't fit what's actually going on. For example, you know, often it's the case we don't know until the investigation is over the name of the officer who was involved in it, whereas anybody else involved in what may end up being charged as a homicide, their name is all over the newspaper well before they end up getting charged. And I think it's a matter of public perception that that issue of transparency perhaps unfairly puts officers in the police in a position where it's perceived they're getting special treatment.
Let's talk about this because this is right up your alley. Jeff Strelson, go ahead.
Well,
this idea of perception, people
sure
feel like it's going to go in favor of the officer no matter what.
Yeah, we not only investigate the use of deadly force by police officers, but also by civilians, meaning private individuals. So we investigate those cases as well, and the law is almost exactly the same, meaning a private citizen also has the right to use deadly force to save himself or another person when they reasonably believe that they're faced with deadly force. So it isn't just police officers' conduct who's examined. It's also private citizens, and we investigate many of those cases as well. In fact, self-defense is probably one of the most common defenses that defendants raise in homicide cases and in assault cases. So private citizens have that same right, and they can claim it as well, and we investigate that the same as well.
There were some numbers that I received, I think from your office, Jeff, that said there were 20 fatal law enforcement events over the last 16 years, and all 20 were ruled justified.
Right.
A member of the public might look at that and go, really? Every single case the officer was justified?
Right, and there were 10 fatal events involving private citizens in 9 years, and those were all ruled justified as well. And in each one of those cases, we examined that case to determine whether or not the individual or individuals who used force complied with the law, and in those cases, they did comply with the law.
Joining us now on the phone is someone who has defended criminal defendants on these types of cases. Mark Sisti is with us. He's a criminal defense attorney from Chichester. Mark Sisti, I know you're getting ready to head into court there. I really appreciate you joining us.
That's not a problem. Good morning.
What's your feeling, Mark, about how these cases of officer-involved shootings are handled in this state, investigated and handled?
Well, frankly, that is the problem. I'm seeing that the public perception may be the 800-pound gorilla that we're unable to remove from the room. What's going on here is that those individuals that have natural suspicion against law enforcement only have those suspicions raised with these investigations that are done, quite frankly, by another law enforcement agency, the Attorney General's office. And those individuals that are trying to understand these activities and these events are really left out in the cold. It's a mystery as to how these events are being reviewed. And this is a mystery that it can be solved. It's been solved in other jurisdictions and other states.
How do other states and other jurisdictions solve it, Mark?
Well, there is no reason, nor do I see it as being some kind of a gigantic problem by involving members of the public or ex-law enforcement personnel, professionals, people in the forensic sciences, and just regular citizen individuals that, like all of us, want to be involved in these types of investigations. All of the folks that you're speaking to right now, other than Officer Willett, Deputy Chief Willett, go through review processes if there are allegations of misbehavior in our profession. That holds true with the medical field as well. And on those review panels are lay people, citizens, common individuals drawn from the community that sit on the panel so that they can hear what's going on with regard to those investigations.
So is that what other states do, Mark? They have like a citizen oversight board that looks at these cases and brings that citizen voice into these investigations? Is that what you're saying?
They do. And they have them not only for deadly force reviews like Jeff's been discussing and Buzz been discussing, but they also have them for those events where an individual is found in his or her jail cell dead. Those are the types of investigations where the public should be involved in some way, shape, or form. It doesn't seem to be an encumbrance, and I think the big bonus is that the police officer or the jail guard that may be cleared after these particular reviews has a neutral and detached panel clearing them, and the public is more confident that it was a true review and it wasn't skewed one way or the other.
How many states have these, Mark, just roughly? Is it most states? Is it a couple states? I mean, I'm just wondering how wide a model this is.
I haven't done a survey to how many there are, but, I mean, I'm aware of other states that have these review boards, and there doesn't seem to be a real massive problem with having them. In fact, it makes a great deal of sense as far as establishing some bond between law enforcement and the public and reassuring the public that this just isn't a whitewash.
Okay. Mark Sisti, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's Mark Sisti, criminal defense attorney from Chichester. Our phone number again for you to join us on this conversation is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can post a comment on our Facebook page. One word, NHPR exchange. And both of you, Buzz and Jeff, I think, Jeff, to you first, you know, Mark called public perception the 800-pound gorilla in the room. The feeling by some citizens that this is one arm of law enforcement investigating another arm of law enforcement. It's a little too cozy, and a citizen oversight board might, well, enhance public confidence in the process. I wonder what you think.
My understanding of those boards is that they conduct a civil review. So those boards are specific to particular police departments. And what they do is they review incidents or complaints, and they make recommendations about policies or procedures. So those boards are not empowered, nor are they able to do criminal investigations. So they would
clear a person's name, so to speak.
Correct. They do something. They do something different. And the second issue is that Mark mentioned the mystery about these investigations, and part of the problem is that people don't read the reports. You know, the reports are put out publicly. There's a lot of documentation and written reports that go with these. In my experience, very few people bother to read those. Even members of the media that call and ask us questions about them, they haven't even read the report. So that would be the starting point. I think if people read those detailed reports, they would have a fuller understanding and appreciation for what occurred. And I believe that's what Deputy Chief Willett had mentioned.
Now, I know you want to jump in, Buzz, but what about the thought, Jeff, that even if you did read the report, and I've looked at some of them, that they've been written by another in law enforcement, that they haven't been written by someone a little more dispassionate, so to speak?
Well, prosecutors make charging decisions, and we make charging decisions about police officers and also private citizens as well. That's what we do, and that's what we're empowered to do. So our office has prosecuted and prosecutes civilians. We also prosecute police officers. So, you know, if people break the law, then we're charged to review it and prosecute those individuals. So that's our job, and that's what we do. But again, the starting point would be to look at what we've done, and then people can judge for themselves whether or not it's been a fair investigation. I think they'll find it has been.
If they look at the whole thing.
Correct.
Buzz, what do you think?
A couple points. One, in terms of the civilian review boards, most of them are review boards, a police department by police department or municipality by municipality. That said, there is a civilian review board effectively in any time there's a shooting. Be it an officer-involved shooting or a civilian-involved shooting, it's called a grand jury. They, you know, a prosecutor has the opportunity to take a case to the grand jury and see what the grand jury thinks. My understanding, not having been a prosecutor, but my understanding is before that happens, there's a decision made by an individual prosecutor, in the case of homicides, the Attorney General's office, whether to take the case to the grand jury, and so you know, it's an interesting question whether how frequently that decision is made. Second, there are some states, for example, in New York City, over the years there have been circumstances where it's not formally called a special prosecutor, but an independent person is appointed by the governor or somebody else to review and make the charging decision so that the law enforcement agency that works closely with the police officers, be it the Attorney General's office or the county attorney's office, is not the one making the decision whether to charge or the one making the decision whether to even take the a case to the grand jury, the formal civilian review board.
So a little bit of a separation there. We're going to go to a short break and then a lot more to talk about. You can join us as well at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm show, Amazon, the U.S. Postal Service, and the push to expand same-day delivery service. Then the director of the British Museum on 20 objects that capture the essence of William Shakespeare's world. All coming up on the Diane Rehm show.
The Diane Rehm show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Clean Yield Asset Management, Norwich, Vermont, tailoring client portfolios for financial performance and social impact, including investments in local agriculture. And Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, Electric, now offering electrical repair and service in addition to furnaces, boilers, and water heaters. Online at justcallheritage.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, another look at mental health in the Granite State and where the state should spend limited dollars. Email us your thoughts at exchange@nhpr.org or comment on our Facebook page at one word, NHPR Exchange. And then be sure to join us tomorrow morning live at 9 for that conversation. Today in The Exchange, we're examining questions about officer-involved shootings in the Granite State, given several recent incidents. Join our conversation, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email exchange@nhpr.org, or our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. I did want to ask both of you a little bit more about the mental health piece, and definitely Jeff Strelzin, you mentioned it, and Officer Willard mentioned it before. Jeff, to you first, but Buzz, I want to hear from you as well. A couple years back, the Concord Monitor did a great series on law enforcement and its interaction with people in a mental health crisis. And the paper found that where officers had extensive training in mental health, these conflicts resolved a lot better, often not in death, than when officers didn't have the training. I wonder what you have seen in terms of when officers have specific training about how to deal with a mental health crisis.
Well, as Deputy Chief Willard said, there's no doubt that additional training can be helpful. And when you go back and look at these cases, you know, they typically break down into one of two categories. One, where you have somebody who's committing a crime and is trying to escape from the police. But the most prevalent category are people who have mental health and or substance abuse issues. And so that's probably the more common theme in a lot of these cases. And so certainly giving more training to the officers is helpful. The problem is the officers are downstream on the problem. And by that I mean by the time they're dealing with someone who has significant mental health issues or substance abuse issues, they're facing someone who's armed with a gun or a knife, and that person isn't capable of using good judgment, and they're coming at that officer or civilian, and the officer really doesn't have many other options.
Yeah, here's an email that came in from Sandy a little while back on this. Sandy says, you need to ask about CITs, Crisis Intervention Teams, a program developed in Memphis. After a shooting of an 84-year-old in Rochester, we formed a team that has diffused many situations with no deaths. Thanks a lot, Sandy, for that email. But sure, what do you think? Police feeling sort of downstream from this broader mental health situation that we have in the state?
Through no fault of their own, they are downstream, and it's very difficult. And, you know, I appreciate your show tomorrow will take a slice of that off. One of the values of more training for police and having crisis intervention teams available is it overcomes what we all struggle with, which is there is this perception out there that the mentally ill are more dangerous than the general population. And statistically, that's just not true, even though the huge majority of people in this country believe that. And, you know, while it's understandable how they believe it, because it feels like those people, at the least, are more unpredictable, it's just that as a statistical proposition, it's not true. So, the understanding that none of these cases are easy, the easier cases are the one where someone has a gun and is wielding it, pointing it at a police officer. That, you know, whether they're mentally ill or not tells you less about the situation than that they have a gun that they're pointing at a police officer. The harder cases are people who have weapons that are less immediately lethal and who are mentally ill, and understanding what the risks are and the unpredictability of the situation increases the more training you have. And, you know, there's a good argument to be made that these CITs, the crisis intervention teams, really are so well trained that's why they're getting the different outcomes. They overcome that lay presumption that afflicts us all that, just as a general proposition, anyone who's mentally ill is more dangerous.
Well, and Buzz, for a moment, if you could take off your law professor hat and put on your New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union hat, the ACLU here in New Hampshire and in a lot of other states is looking at this issue of whether police are over-militarized. Yes. We've talked about that here on The Exchange, especially with the Bearcat issue here in Concord.
Mm-hmm.
Does that play a role in what we're talking about today? Police having lots of armaments, and the ACLU has been concerned, more willing to use them. What do you think?
I think there's a risk that it sets a tone. If the tone in a police department is over militarized, then one can imagine that there's more of an inclination to use weaponry rather than to use words. And I think that's the risk with police officers either consciously or unconsciously feeling like it is a war and feeling like they're operating as soldiers in a war and having a lot more armaments the more that feeling imbues a police department, the greater the risk that it's weapons rather than words are used to resolve the situation.
Yeah, and Jeff, I'm sure you've heard about this too, especially a couple months back when the Bearcat debate was exploding here in Concord. What are your thoughts on that? Police becoming more militarized today. Lots of hand-me-downs from the federal government. And police, as we heard from Nick Willard, feeling more vulnerable given that the public is armed and given the mental health crisis in the state.
Yeah, I mean, I think the vast majority of our cases involve officers just using handguns, meaning it's not really a situation where they're using heavy firepower. Where that comes in is when there are standoffs, and that's when maybe a SWAT team gets involved, and every effort is made to try and negotiate with the person who's inside and try and talk that person out. And thankfully, most of those are very, very successful. Most of our officer-involved deadly force situations, though, involve things happening very, very quickly within a matter of seconds or minutes, and so there isn't time to get somebody else there. It's just a police officer
to bring in the SWAT team, so
right?
To speak.
So, police officer who encounters someone in a hallway or in a street, somewhere where they're faced with someone with a weapon, there just isn't time, and so they happen very, very quickly. But obviously, if there's time, it makes sense to try and negotiate, and that's what the police do.
You know, Nick Willard talked about something else that I wanted to follow up on with both of you. And you first, Jeff, please. The idea that police try to, using their best judgment in a fraught situation, reach for a lower level use of force
right first.
I'm interested in that.
Yes, police officers do sometimes have what's called less lethal options to them. And a taser is probably the one that's best known to everyone. Obviously, in some situations, and Deputy Chief Willard mentioned the Dan Doherty case where Officer Doherty had already been shot multiple times, that officer is not going to reach for something besides their handgun. But we have had cases where officers have used tasers to try and stop a situation where a suspect is coming at them, for instance, with a knife. And often it doesn't work. What happens is the taser itself malfunctions. It simply doesn't work. Or the officer fires it, the taser requires two probes to hit the individual, and one of the probes misses and it doesn't work. And then what has also happened is they simply don't work against some people. The person may just for whatever reason be brush the probes off themselves, or just it's not affecting them because of the drugs that they're on. And so there have been cases where we've had where police officers have tried to use those things and they just haven't worked. They obviously do work in a lot of situations and that's great, but they're not going to work every time. And if someone's coming at you with a gun or a shotgun, you're likely not going to have time to use that less lethal force.
It makes me wonder if there's some sort of technology that needs to be developed that's better than a taser but not as fatal as a gun.
Well, that's the problem, though. You're trying to walk that line between something that's obviously fatal and something that isn't. And so the more effective your less lethal option is, the more likely it is to be fatal, and you're trying to find something that's in between.
Go ahead, Buzz.
The difficult case to me that brings much of what we're talking about today together and is the recent case in Washington D.C. where a woman in a car tried to run the barricade in front of the White House, and then a chase ensued, and she ended up getting shot. It was clear after the fact, but not at the time apparently, that she had some mental health issues. There also appeared, again, after the fact, I think the police found out that there was a young child in the car. But the question that, based on what I've looked at so far, again, the full report is not out. The question is, at the point she was shot, was she trying to run a police officer over, or was she trying to escape? There had been something of a chase there. And what about the option of, given that there was a massive police response to her?
Sure, because it was the White House.
What about the option of an understandable massive police response? What about the option of shooting the car's tires out? My understanding is, again, based on what I've read publicly, is there was no sense that she was wielding any other weapon other than the car. So it brings together a bunch of these issues in a very difficult situation, particularly given the potential terrorism aspect of it, to it, at least up front, given that she tried to run the barricade to the White House. It's a really hard case that raises a lot of these questions.
Well, I'm glad you raised it, though, Buzz, because in the Manchester situation, with the AG, which the AG's office ruled on just recently, Jeff, the loved ones of the woman who died, Wendy Lawrence, one of them did say, you know, she was trying to get away. Couldn't they have just shot the tires out. Now, clearly, we're not going to go into this whole case. You guys have issued your report. But that's a feeling that the public has with a fleeing suspect. You know, they're not shooting at you. Can't you just shoot their tires out and disable the car?
Yeah, a couple different comments. First of all, you know, a lot of what, you know, we all learn about how police do their job and prosecutors do their job is from television. And television cases get solved in 45 minutes. And police officers are able to shoot guns out of people's hands from a mile away and shoot the tires of cars.
Are you saying television's not quite really how it happens?
Sometimes it is. But, you know, in real life, anyone who's used a handgun realizes they're not all that accurate at great distances. And, you know, if a police officer shoots at tires, it's likely not going to stop that vehicle. And second, if they miss, they may hit someone else and injure or kill someone else. So that's not going to be effective. The other part of it is that if somebody's trying to run you down with a car, shooting their tires is not going to stop the threat and stop them. And the last thing is that I don't know what the law is in Washington, but in New Hampshire and a lot of other states, police officers can use deadly force to effect an arrest or prevent an escape if certain circumstances exist. And so there are a lot of additional criteria that have to be there. Police officers just can't shoot someone who's trying to escape. But if there are certain factors there, if there are certain threats there, they can use deadly force to prevent an escape or effect an arrest.
So they have to be looking at the whole situation, Jeff, and whether this car is being used as a deadly weapon, whether there are bystanders, others who might be hit by this car.
Right. And you can imagine a scenario where, you know, a police officer is faced with somebody who's been in a high-speed chase. They're fleeing from the police. They're trying to get away from the police. And the officer doesn't try to stop that person when that person tries to run them down. If that person drives 100 feet down the road and runs over a kid who's playing in the road, people are going to say that police officer didn't do his job. He was a coward. He should be held responsible. So, you know, the officers, as Buzz Scheer mentioned, the officers are trying to balance very difficult decisions and within a very, very short period of time.
I want to ask both of you one more question as we wrap up, and it relates to something that Nick Willard said, again, Manchester's assistant police chief. Buzz, to you first, you know, he talked about Manchester Police having extra training, three more rounds of training than required by state law. And he mentioned that Chief Mara there has reacted to the killing of Michael Briggs, saying that law enforcement in Manchester needs more training when it comes to the use of deadly force. What do you think more broadly, Buzz, the killing of Michael Briggs and then later Greenland's police chief, does this affect the way that police might be reacting to these situations?
I think they were both very difficult circumstances. And I think inevitably going forward that it has some influence on an officer's perception of the risk he or she faces when confronted with a challenging circumstance. So I don't think officers would be human if it didn't affect, at least at an intuitive or unconscious level, their perception of the level of risk and perhaps in the short term put them more on edge. And, you know, I applaud the Manchester Police Department for having the three extra trainings a year, because it appears from what Nick Willard had to say that it's made, his perception was that it's made a difference. So, yeah, police officers wouldn't be human if it didn't affect them. But I encourage other police departments to engage in this kind of training to help moderate that understandable instinct.
What do you think, Jeff? Officers more on edge, given what we've seen in recent years?
I mean, I think what Deputy Chief Wold said is correct, that it's they've taken it the right way. They've done more training, and I know other police departments have done that as well. It's kind of the reaction that the public had after the Mont Vernon cases. People got dogs, they got guns, they got alarm systems. There's nothing wrong with taking appropriate steps after an event like that, as long as you moderate and temper what you do.
What do you think? Your final thoughts? Maybe I'll turn to you first, Buzz Scheer. Your final thoughts as we look at how these cases are viewed by the public and investigated by the state, the AG's office.
We haven't talked about this much, but I would encourage the Attorney General's office and the police in general to be more transparent earlier in the process about the process that's unfolding and about the people involved. I think that will encourage the public to have a more positive perception that people, both civilians and police, are being treated the same way and fairly.
What do you think, Jeff?
Well, we treat officer-involved cases like we do any of the homicide case, meaning we apply the same rules. And when we have an ongoing investigation, we don't reveal all the details because that would impact our ability to carry out the investigation. And the other part of it is that often the information we have early on is not accurate, so we're trying to be as accurate and thorough as possible. So just like a news media organization would do an investigative report, they wouldn't release their findings halfway through. They wait till they're done. And that's what we do, and we try and do it as quickly and accurately as possible.
I wonder if a culture where people want the information instantly, now, let's put it out on Twitter now, if that affects the way that you guys are perceived.
I think that's part of it. And also, again, it's what people learn from TV is that police officers and prosecutors solve the crime within 45 minutes, that we have unlimited resources, and that's not the real world.
All right. It's been great to talk to both of you. And Jeff Strelzin, thank you very much for being here.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Jeff Strelzin, Senior Assistant Attorney General, Chief of the Homicide Unit. Buzz Schur, always a pleasure. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Buzz Schur, Professor at UNH Law and President of the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm and John Barrett. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, meeting out money for mental health care. Recent violent incidents involving psychiatric patients have renewed calls for shoring up services. But with rising need and limited dollars, how best can we use funding? Should we add more acute care hospital beds, boost community services, focus on drug and alcohol treatment, or diseases like schizophrenia? Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show is next at 10 on NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Franklin Pierce University, connecting you to a career that matters. Learn more at franklinpierce.edu. And Goose Bay Lumber of Chichester, providing specialty lumber for wood artisans, furniture craftsmen, turners, and boat builders, plus gift certificates for the holidays. GooseBayLumber.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
Good morning, it's 10 o'clock. And this is NHPR. We seem to be having